From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Although Jane Goodall is best known for her groundbreaking work as a primatologist, her latest book, Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating, is, as the title suggests, about food. It is published by Warner Books, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Goodall back to my show today. Hello.
Hello, and it's nice to be back.
Now, of course, as I said, most people know you as an advocate for chimps. How did you come to write a book about healthier food? Is there a link?
Well, there's a sort of link in that when I began traveling further and further around the world, raising awareness about the plight of chimpanzees and vanishing forests, I became increasingly aware of the environmental concerns everywhere and of the extent to which we're polluting and destroying this beautiful planet. And I became aware of the impact of agriculture and our eating behavior on the environment, on animal suffering, animal welfare, and on human health. And if you care passionately about the future of the planet and our children, then, you know, this is a very natural extension of my concern.
Are the farms that are being created that are destroying the natural habitat of the chimps and other animals, are they at least good farms?
There's farms and farms, and the tragedy really is that the small family farms are increasingly being pushed away and their place being taken by agribusiness, by the huge farms with their chemical pesticides and fertilizers and their monoculture and increasingly genetically modified food forms. So, you know, that's one horror. And more country is being used in order to grow corn or provide grazing for cattle to supply a wealthier population's increasing need for meat around the world. And that leads to a huge waste of water because it takes so much more water to raise cattle and other livestock than it does to grow grain that can feed people with vegetable protein.
Now, what you're saying is similar to what a UN report, the Millennium Report, that was released, earlier this year, after a five-year study, pointed out. They said, unless we stop the pollution and degradation caused by industrial farming and address overfishing and global warming, we will literally run out of enough resources to feed everyone by 2050.
Absolutely.
So how seriously do you think that most of the countries of the world are taking that report?
Well, unfortunately, an awful lot of people simply are not aware of the problems. I mean, I really think that if most people, say, in the United States or the UK or somewhere like that, knew exactly what went on in the intensive farms, what happened to the animals, they would be as revolted as I am, and they wouldn't want to eat that meat. And, you know, even if they're not moved by the animal suffering, they can be persuaded how bad it is because of its impact on human health.
But you say they wouldn't want to eat that meat. One of the revelations of your early research was you discovered that chimps ate a lot more meat than anyone thought they did. They were assumed to be mostly vegetarians, weren't they? And once in a while ate a little meat. They'd catch a stray baboon. You discovered that meat was a major part of their diet.
No, it's maximum 2% of the diet throughout a year. It's just that they have a meat-eating orgy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the meat they eat is raw, and, of course, it's lived a free and healthy life before they kill it. So in this new book, you know, while it's clear that a diet based on heavy meat eating is bad for everything, animals, the environment, and ourselves, if we must eat meat, I don't, but some people feel they must, to eat the flesh of an animal that's had some grazing, that hasn't been pumped with antibiotics, that's free range and grass fed, you know, that's very, very different from eating these poor prisoners who, from their point of view, they're in concentration camps.
So all primates eat a very small percentage of their diet is meat?
No, not at all. No, it's just some. Many of the monkeys, the leaf-eating monkeys and so forth, they never eat meat. It's just simply not not in their repertoire. And wild gorillas haven't been seen to eat meat, and I think not orangutans either. It just shows chimpanzees really are so like us in so many ways.
And what about bonobos, do we know?
I don't think they've been seen to eat meat yet. They will eat it in captivity, as will the other great apes.
How has our diet affected our evolution as a species?
I think that there's one theory propounded by Richard Wrangham and some of the other professors at Harvard, which suggests that once cooking came into play and once foods could be cooked and meat could be cooked, that that had a major impact on the way our teeth developed and on all kinds of other aspects of life.
But even within the modern world, I've been told that a Chinese chef working here in the United States is easily spotted as having come from China if there's a lot less meat in the mix of the dish. But if he's worked here for a long time, there'll be a higher proportion of meat because we expect that extra meat, and so do the Chinese who've come to live in the United States.
Yes, and the tragedy is that this whole culture has now been taken over to China, so the Chinese are beginning to want more meat. And, you know, this is the nightmare. If all the Chinese people decide they want the same amount of meat as the average American, then there'll be no land left for anything except raising cattle.
But is that because meat has come to mean status in most cultures?
I think it is. But, you know, on the other hand, there are vast populations in the world who never touch meat. And
In India especially.
In India especially, any of the Buddhist countries, Hindu. And I would say that in the United States and certainly in many parts of Europe, vegetarianism is definitely on the increase. And it's a mixture of people who are repelled by the suffering of the animals and the people who are shocked at the impact of intensively farmed meat or too much meat on human health.
Is the higher proportion of meat in the Chinese diet one of the reasons that we're hearing that there is more obesity in China than there was in the past?
Well, it's that, but it's also the fact that they've also embraced fast food with its fatty content. And, you know, this is a big tragedy. It's even starting in Japan. And it's so sad that the worst parts of a culture tend to get exported. That's very sad to me. But, you know, as I say, there is an awakening. There are more and more people who are patronizing organic food stores like Whole Foods and who are buying from farmers' markets, who are joining cooperatives and getting boxes of organic vegetables. And urban farming is on the increase around the world.
But Whole Foods also sells meat.
But they it's almost entirely, and getting more so, meat from animals that are farmed in the old traditional way.
So it's fine if we eat beef as long as the cattle grazed on grass and weren't fed instead
not
corn.
If we eat large amounts, it's not, because they need the grass and they waste the water. So it's if we must eat meat, it should be a small amount of humanely raised and grass-fed cattle.
You quote Dr. Tetsu Chang, head of the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. He says, what people call progress, hydroelectric dams, roads, logging, modern agriculture, is putting us on a food supply tightrope. We're losing strains of wild crops and domesticated crops everywhere. How do dams and roads and logging wind up destroying old crops?
Because I think it opens up the way, and you tend to find all these dams provide water for irrigation so that the international agribusiness can come in and start growing their monocultures. And they can provide the food cheaper, so the traditional farmers can no longer compete on the marketplace. And this happens with subsidized corn grown in the States, shipped to Mexico, for example, so that all the Mexican farmers who farmed for hundreds of years are driven into the towns looking for jobs.
I'm talking with Jane Goodall, whose latest book is not about chimpanzees. It's about eating. It's called Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. It's from Warner Books. This is WNYC. So do you blame industrial-style agribusiness for much of the this current situation, this current mess?
Yes, I do, because they really have claimed huge areas of land, and they are polluting that land, and they are irrigating land that really isn't suitable for growing crops.
But they're claiming that they're doing something a lot more efficiently than small farmers could.
Well, and that actually turns out not to be true, and I don't pretend to be an expert on all of this. I have to rely on farmers I talk to and books that I've read. You know, I'm not an expert, and I don't want to pretend that I am. But there's enough facts out there, if you look it all up, that shows that small farmers can actually be just as efficient, and they're not destroying the land, and the food they produce is healthy, and the farmers can make a living. So we have to try and support the small farmers. It's very, very important.
Well, what I find interesting is that we usually associate the small farmers with organic or something similar, and the industrial style agribusinesses as making the other stuff. But now we're seeing many multinationals producing organic foods as well.
Yeah, they've noticed the trend, and it's what people are calling, I think, shallow organic. It means that it doesn't necessarily mean you spend 3 years and you clear the ground, but it simply means you're not using pesticides, chemicals of that sort. And that, of course, is a step in the right direction.
When did we start using these chemicals on our crops?
After World War II. They're chemicals that were actually developed as weapons of mass destruction during World War II. And it's not just on the crops. I mean, you know, aspartame, the artificial sweetener, that didn't get into the book because it didn't impinge upon me. But that was discovered by a chemist who was working on creating chemical weapons of mass destruction after World War II. And aspartame is a poison.
And it winds up being a sweetener.
So many things.
Of course, sugar, some people say, is also a poisoner.
Well,
so I guess you choose your poison there.
I don't think that pure sugar is a poisoner at all.
So we use nerve gases to spray our crops with. Have there been side effects from that?
We're seeing a huge, huge increase, I think. I mean, you can argue about this. People say the statistics have to be related to the growth of the population and the way that the statistics are taken. But, you know, my friends are coming down everywhere with cancer. Childhood leukemia has increased and asthma. There's just so much disease.
You mentioned a study done on Mexican children, and one of the side effects was a tendency towards physical aggression.
Physical aggression, and particularly from too much sugar. And that's what you mean by saying sugar can be a poison. Too much sugar is a poison. Little amounts of sugar are fine. But too much sugar increases aggression. They did some wonderful studies in prisons. And when they removed sugar from the diet, the incidences of aggression within the prisoners dropped dramatically.
There have been campaigns to change things back to the old ways all over the world, but it seems to be less of a concern in the United States. Why do you think that is?
I suppose that there is such a power that the big corporations have over the food, the pharmaceuticals, and people are sometimes intimidated. I know with things, for example, like genetically modified food, that the big corporations can be intimidating.
They sue critics.
I understand that there is a brand of food that claims on its label there are no genetically modified organisms in it, and I'm told that they're being sued. Well, I mean, this is clearly absurd.
You write that we consume more pesticides by eating meat than the plants that they're used on. Why is that?
Well, first, for one thing, the cattle are typically fed, or the chickens, on grain that has had pesticides used on it, so that's in their bodies already, and so we get it double.
But haven't the multinationals moved away from pesticide use and towards genetically modified food production because the public was concerned?
They have. That's the irony of it all. But, you know, all these crops, they have made into their genes now pesticide resistance. And the whole, I wish I understood better exactly how genetically modified foods are made, but it's something which animals hate genetically modified food. I pay a lot of attention to what animals like and what they don't.
So have we reduced our dependency on pesticides because we've developed these genetically modified foods?
I don't think so, because the pesticides, the fertilizers, the chemicals of all sort, the industrial chemicals and the household chemicals are also getting out into the food chain.
Now, we are usually told that progress involves applying the results of pure science to the real world. Isn't that what happened with genetically modified things?
I suppose that's how it began in the first place. And, you know, the proponents of GM foods are very passionate that it's going to solve world hunger. But on the other side, there are people who are equally scientific, including people who've worked on genetically modified food production, who've now turned away and said, we wish we'd never done it. It's wrong.
As I understand it, this is not just an American thing.
No,
that
so
there
everywhere
are many, a number of European companies that are also involved in GM foods.
Yes, and so. In Britain and many parts of Europe, there are people who go and pull them out of the fields. And, of course, our strong proponent against GM foods is Prince Charles, who's been very outspoken.
Well, there are any number of Europeans who have as well, in France, for example, and yet we see a continued growth of this. So are they just trying to hold back the tide?
Trying to hold back the tide, but it's not just Europe. There are countries like India and Japan that are equally against introducing GM foods. Many other countries, Ethiopia, the Minister of Agriculture wants the entire country to become organic and to have no chemicals and no GM foods. So there's a sort of war going on, and you tend to think that the giants are going to win. But it's we, the people. We have the power. We don't have to buy this stuff.
Although there are only a few major GM crops, aren't there? Soy, corn,
soy,
canola.
Of the three main ones, yes. But that soy, particularly the corn and the corn syrup, gets into everything.
And soy is a basic ingredient of not only Western foods, but Asian foods,
yes,
especially.
Exactly.
So are the Japanese and the Chinese also using genetically modified soy?
Japanese, as far as I know, have resisted. The Chinese are indeed using it.
My guest is Jane Goodall, whose latest book is Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating, written with Gary McAvoy and Gail Hudson and published by Warner Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Stay with us. We're back with Jane Goodall, who's written a new book called Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. It's from Warner Books and written with the help of Gary McAvoy and Gail Hudson. Jane Goodall, of course, is the famous primatologist, the founder of the Gombe Research Center and the Jane Goodall Institute for Wildlife Research, Education, and Conservation. She has been named Commander of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth II and has received numerous distinguished awards in science and written several bestsellers, including Reason for Hope. I guess that was the inspiration for calling this Harvest for Hope.
Yes, it was.
And we're talking about genetically modified foods. Now, do genetically modified foods maintain the nutritional value of the older form or whatever we want to call, I don't want to keep on saying non-genetically modified.
Normal food, sort of original food. I'm not sure about that.
I read that there was a study by a Hungarian scientist who said that it doesn't, but then the U.S. Food and Drug Administration says that it does.
Well, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration says that aspartame doesn't harm you. So, you know, what do you believe?
Now, aspartame is in a lot of diet sodas, isn't it?
Oh, yes. It is. I was horrified. I mean, I honestly only recently learned about this, and I read a complete breakdown of how long it took to get this to be approved by FDA, and they had to remove two directors of FDA before this could happen.
But then, on the other hand, the non-diet sodas have mostly corn syrups in them as sweeteners, and you're suggesting that they are likely to be genetically modified as well.
Probably. They probably are likely to be genetically modified.
Now, does it really matter if we were able to separate the genetically modified foods from the others, or are there other problems? You say that they also spread uncontrollably.
They do. I mean, Percy Schmeiser, the Canadian who stood up to one of these companies, Monsanto, you know, his field was invaded. They accused him of stealing, inappropriately obtaining the seeds, but they eventually withdrew that and admitted it was brought in by wind or bees.
Well, they were accusing him of patent infringement.
Yes.
Here he was not planting their seed, and yet some of their stuff was found on his land.
Right.
So the seeds had just blown in from his neighbor's farm?
They'd been blown in or with bees pollination or something like that. Turned out they grew in the ditches alongside the fields. That's where it came from. But he was actually accused not only of violating the patent, which held in court, he was accused of that and he lost that, but he was accused of willfully taking the seeds and planting them, which that they withdrew.
Can't they also cross-pollinate?
If
you have two fields of corn and one is organically grown heritage corn and the other is genetically modified, won't bees cross-pollinate?
They do.
What happens?
Well, then your organic farmer loses his organic license. And the real worry was down in Mexico, where they have these heirloom corns, which is the corn, you know, the sort of seed bank for the whole world. Even there, these genetically modified plants have appeared.
There were studies on it's the impact on the monarch butterfly.
Yes.
Have we ever resolved that?
No. The caterpillars died when they ate leaves on which the pollen had fallen. But it was never done as a big major test. Therefore, it was discounted.
You focus a lot on Monsanto's practices in your book. Are they the worst culprit in your eyes?
Well, I think they're the biggest. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean I think all of the companies doing this are exactly the same, and Monsanto happens to be successful, so it's more in the news.
But they also were the ones who had the great idea of patenting seeds. Until the seeds were patented, it was assumed that you could not put a patent on a genetic material.
Nor should you. I think it's completely wrong.
The U.S. and Canada don't require labeling their genetically modified foods. Are there a lot of countries that do?
All over Europe, you have to actually label the food, that if it has GM known to have it in, then they have to declare that that is so.
So are most of the genetically modified crops being grown in the United States and Canada?
Canada and the U.S., both.
But what about other countries? Has this spread to countries that have serious food shortages? Mexico has often talked about trying to improve its crop yields.
Well, China, for one. China's definitely growing them. Brazil, they were encouraging people to pull them out of the fields, but then suddenly there was an about change, and Brazil accepted genetically modified foods in. And it's patchy. There are some places in Europe where some GM foods are grown, but there's still people pulling them out of the ground.
Well, you mentioned that Ethiopia just refused to allow this sort of thing to happen. Is that the way you would like to see the rest of the world react?
Yes, because, you know, we have here an ethical issue. First of all, these companies are maintaining that GM food is the answer to hunger, and there are people equally passionately saying no because it's putting the poor farmers out of business, the money is going into government pockets. And people are starving much more than they were before, and they're losing all their old cultural ways, the way that they for hundreds of years have grown the crops that could withstand famine, that could withstand drought, that could withstand flooding. Those things are vanishing and the knowledge is vanishing. And it's, I find this really tragic and scary.
My guest is Jane Goodall. Her latest book is Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. It has nothing to do with chimps, although chimps do come up in the book now and then. It's published by Warner Books and written with the help of Gary McAvoy and Gail Hudson. Since the foods aren't labeled as having containing genetically modified ingredients and not in this country, how can we even know which ones to avoid?
You can't. All you can do is to be as organic as you possibly can. I know that's tough for some people. They can't always afford it. But everything that you, if you can possibly buy food that's organic, you know you're safe.
Although there are some websites that are trying to track them down. I know there's Gene Watch and there's the True Food Network website. I don't know how many foods how they can actually find out. I guess they have to do genetic testing on every food.
That's really difficult and it's almost impossible. I mean, it is going to be have to be the consumer that makes the choices.
But there are many genetically modified crops that are not sold in the supermarket. Much of the corn that's genetically modified is simply used as animal feed. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. And when some of that accidentally got out into the human food chain, it was being sold. There was a great outbreak of quite nasty illness that was associated with that. So if that corn is being fed to the cattle and then we're eating the meat of the cattle, how can we say what the long-term effect of that might be? I mean, these are all the questions which, you know, are not answered. And I'm deeply suspicious.
You said that you are a vegetarian. Is that because of ethical reasons or others? I know you have a number of chapters in the book that look into the condition of animals in slaughterhouses. Is that what changed your mind about eating meat?
What changed my mind was coming back from a long spell in the field in Africa, reading Peter Singer's book, which was in the mid-70s. I didn't know about intensive farming. You know, it didn't exist in my childhood when I worked on a farm. And I was so shocked, and I looked at this piece of meat on my plate, and it suddenly symbolized for me fear, pain, death. I didn't want to eat it, so I haven't eaten meat since that day.
Is there a way to create humane slaughterhouses?
Yes.
Or should we say abattoirs? Nobody uses that word anymore.
Abattoir, slaughterhouses. Yes, there are farmers who actually go with their cattle to the slaughterhouses. There are ways of making it less objectionable. But, you know, I've come to just the very thought of these animals being killed and me eating them has now become something I just don't want to do.
Then there's a whole matter of how the animals are fattened up, isn't there?
Yes, with the growth hormones. And to be kept alive, they're fed antibiotics. And those antibiotics are getting out and bacteria are building up resistance and superbugs are being bred.
As I understand it, if cows, for example, graze, then they don't need to have antibiotics.
Right.
Antibiotics. But if they're eating this grain that can carry germs, then they need the antibiotics. So we have this self-perpetuating situation. Mm,
it's not only that. It's that the conditions in the intensive farms are so stressful that, you know, they get sick much more easily. Their immune system's compromised.
Aren't we also tinkering with the DNA of some of these animals, creating pigs that are so fat they can't walk and cows
and
that can't mate?
Turkeys and chickens. It's disgusting. Yes, we are. Cows can't breed naturally. The Belgian Blue, it's called. It got been bred with these great huge legs for meat. And what about the udders of the cows? Infected? You drink pus with your milk.
The United States allows milk to contain more pus cells because of growth hormone-induced infections than any other country in the world.
That's right.
And yet, we're fairly healthy here, aren't we?
No, I don't think we are. I said earlier, but, you know, the number of people I know who are getting all sorts of dire diseases quite early, and I'm not going to say that they're directly linked to any of this, but it certainly makes one suspicious.
You also cite a couple of examples of animals actually escaping from the slaughterhouses. Where did they go?
Well, they try and take refuge wherever they can. They hide away, and usually people are soft-hearted, and if an animal makes a determined bid and escapes certain death, you know, like somebody on death row, they're usually gathered up by humane societies and put on sanctuary farms.
You also bring up the problem of animal waste, which is something we don't hear talked about as much as antibiotics and GM foods. How serious is animal waste?
I think it's hugely serious. And there was one flood, and I can't remember which year it was, when the waste from the hog farms in, was it Iowa, somewhere like that, and it contaminated the rivers, went right out into the sea, into the coastal waters, right down the coast for miles. It caused fish to die. It caused fishermen, anybody who went into the water got severe burning of the skin, and they got sick. And people living around these hog farms, they can't come out some days. I mean, it's absolutely horrific.
Well, the smell, I understand, is just too awful.
And when Robert Kennedy went and did pro bono work on behalf of these people, because they're too poor to have their own legal fees paid, and actually got a judge to prosecute some of the hog barons for violating the Clean Water Act, the hog barons then sat down with some politicians, and the FDA were pulled in, and the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, they rewrote the legislation so that the hog barons were no longer in violation.
You cite one of the benefits of going organic is slowing down global warming. How would that work?
Well, it's actually organic. It's the eating locally that slows down global warming.
And if you eat locally, even if it isn't officially organic, it is still kind of organic.
But basically, you know, so people now expect to be able to go and buy peaches at any time of the year. They go into their supermarket and there's a peach. And if it's not the peach season where they live, where's it come from? How far has it come? How was it kept looking fresh? What was done to it?
You have started Jane Goodall's Institute's Roots and Shoots Global Program for Youth. What is that all about?
That's actually the program I'm putting most of my energy into now, because what's the point of killing myself trying to save chimps and forests if we're not raising new generations to be better stewards? So it's about kids choosing projects to make the world better for animals, people, and environment. It's now in 90 countries with about 8,000 active groups, and kids are changing the world as we speak.
Jane Goodall's latest book is Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating, written with Gary McAvoy and Gail Hudson and published by Warner Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.